This is a Triple J podcast.
Zero.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest. If
no, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
Should we be censoring the tics of people with Tourette's syndrome? What if the tic is highly offensive, the worst of racial slurs? Because there's been a massive backlash after the N-word was broadcast during a British awards ceremony. Some saying that's unacceptable, others that it shouldn't be covered up. So what is the answer? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're going to speak with someone with Tourette's syndrome, Connor from Big Brother, and he's got thoughts on what went down at the BAFTAs this week.
There is zero intent. To censor their disability is almost, in a way, its own discrimination.
Yeah, that chat is coming up very soon. I'm keen to hear your thoughts as well. Also ahead, is Australia about to get a fast train? And when I say about, I mean it's at least a decade away, because the government has announced some money for a high-speed rail link between Newcastle and Sydney. Do you think it's a good investment or it's a waste of money? Very keen to hear from you. First, though,
Hack.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has written an extraordinary letter saying he would support any proposal to remove Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor from the royal line of succession.
On Triple J.
Yeah, he's the least popular member of the royal family, but he could still be king. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. He was stripped of his titles over his ties to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, but you might not know, he's still eighth in line to the throne, which means technically he is still a chance at being Australia's head of state. Calls are growing, though, to kick him off the line of succession, and Australia has been quick to support that idea. Is it something you think needs to be dealt with? Do you care? Message in 0439 757 555. Hack political reporter Monty Bovell's been looking into it.
I think that Australians are disgusted.
King Charles's brother, Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, is having a pretty big fall from grace. Last year, he lost the title Prince over his ties to the dead sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, while on Friday, he spent several hours being interviewed by British police. Now, there's this.
The Australian government regards these allegations and regards Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor as being not appropriate to be in the line of succession, to be our head of state.
It's been 3.5 weeks since the US Justice Department dumped 3 million documents online from its Epstein investigation, and overnight, British police made another arrest.
Why did many people meet him? He was a prolific networker, and I wish I'd never met him.
The UK's former ambassador to the US, Peter Mandelson, was sacked over his links to Epstein in September. Now he's under investigation.
It's a sad day for British politics and trust in the British political system.
Nick Rowley worked as a policy advisor in the UK government.
It seems that he was issuing information very quickly from the very heart of decision-making following the global financial crisis directly to someone who potentially could financially gain from that information.
Both Peter Mandelson and Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor have been released for now. Both deny they did anything wrong.
Trump's State of the Union address is scheduled for Tuesday, and it may have just been ruined. Here's why. Epstein victim Danny Bensky is going to attend as a guest of Chuck Schumer.
Over in the US, there's still millions more documents in the Epstein files that haven't been released. Donald Trump's continuing to say he's been totally exonerated by the documents released so far.
I'm the one that can talk about it because I've been totally exonerated. I did nothing.
Some of the survivors hope there'll be more prosecutions.
Australia likes being first.
Back to Andrew. So despite having his royal titles being removed, Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor remains eighth in line to the throne, which means it's still possible he could end up King of Australia. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is the first Commonwealth leader to back removing him from the line of succession.
What we're doing is preparing, and already Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, the fact that we're calling him that rather than Prince Andrew, indicates that there's already been moves along those lines.
It's not an easy process, though. It needs to be started by the UK, And then the 14 countries that have the king as their head of state need to agree. New Zealand is up for it too.
We've already been in conversation with the UK Cabinet Office and they know that we are supportive. Should they remove him from the line of succession, we would be very supportive of that decision.
Australia would also have to get agreement from all of the states and territories too, which could take several years. But it has been done before.
When they wanted to change the rule of succession so that males didn't get preference over females.
With the families of Princes William and Harry ahead of him, the likelihood of former Prince Andrew becoming king is low. Extremely low. So University of Sydney constitutional law expert Anne Toomey says it's more symbolic.
You wouldn't ordinarily bother with this kind of legislation.
The whole situation has brought the role of the royals in Australia back into focus. So what about a republic? The Prime Minister says there's no appetite for that.
The government doesn't have any plans to hold a referendum.
Hack on Triple J. Monty Bovell reporting there. We're hearing from you on the text line. Someone says, yeah, kick him out of anything to do with Australia, that person says. Also on Hack's Instagram as well, lots of comments pouring through on this story. Someone says, become a republic and none of this actually matters. Another person says, we don't care. All right, some strong opinions. We're going to move on.
Hack.
The BBC is apologising for airing a racial slur during the BAFTAs.
The tics you've heard tonight are involuntary, which means the person who has Tourette's syndrome has no control over their language.
Tourette's has zero boundaries. It doesn't care who you are, what situation you're in. Your brain locks into the worst possible thing you could say.
Triple J.
Have you seen the controversy around a racial slur being broadcast at the BAFTAs this week? A lot of the world's rich and famous were gathered for the British Academy Film Awards. It's a big event. But during the ceremony, a Tourette syndrome activist, John Davidson, who inspired a movie that was nominated for an award, shouted several times. And that included using the N-word while actors Delroy Lindo and Michael B. Jordan were on stage. Now, Davidson later apologised. He said it was not a reflection of his personal beliefs, but there has been a lot of debate about this. The BBC was forced to apologise for not editing it out of the broadcast that was played 2 hours after the live event. And it is a really complicated situation because people have different views on what is appropriate and what is not. Connor Macy is a disability advocate, and you may remember him from the most recent season of Big Brother, where he spoke a lot about living with Tourette syndrome. I'm so glad to say he's with us now to chat about all this. G'day, Connor. Thanks for coming on.
No, thank you for having me.
What's your reaction to what happened at the BAFTAs? I mean, it's making a lot of headlines around the world. As someone with Tourette syndrome, what do you feel when you see the discussion around all of this?
It's so interesting to see so many different perspectives and sides of the conversation. I'm definitely of an opinion that I don't necessarily think that there is a right answer with things like this. We're kind of in like several gray zones when it comes to making sure that everyone feels included.
How do you feel about how everything was handled? I mean, there's obviously criticism of the BBC saying that outbursts should have been cut out of the broadcast.
I think Tourette's and media is always going to be difficult with the nature of it. I think from my own personal perspective, when I went on Big Brother, I made it really clear with them that I didn't want to be censored, because then it comes into the weeds of like, what do you decide to censor? What do you not decide to censor? And I think on that front, it's my opinion that like, it's all about intent when it comes to words like these. And I think that when it comes to a person with Tourette's, there is zero intent. And to censor their disability is almost in a way its own discrimination. For me, a lot of where I see a problem here is that they chose to censor some things during the broadcast and then not censor others.
So in your view, would it have been better to either censor everything or not censor anything?
100%, exactly. Pick one lane or the other. There's no point trying to pick and choose. You're either being open and honest, or you're kind of, you know, just turning it all off and saying, well, you know, it's happening for the people that are there, but we'll censor it for everybody that's at home because it's not appropriate for our broadcast. Because there are still some broadcasting standards that they have to follow.
It is a really difficult situation because on one hand, you do have someone who can't help this tick and felt mortified and apologised for it profusely afterwards. And then you have those who can't help feeling disrespected or embarrassed or like they've been targeted, I guess. Is that the daily reality of living with Tourette's syndrome, is encountering these situations and trying to figure out a way of explaining things, or how difficult is it?
Super difficult, because it's something that I'm dealing with every day. Pissed. Sorry, I just blanked then.
That's fine. Do you want me to
the nature of some tics. Sometimes your brain is like, fine, you can hold on to the thought you had. And other times it's just like, well, there we go.
Can I ask you about that, Connor? Like, what happens when you have a tic? What's the experience like?
So I guess there's kind of two primary experiences with a tic. There are ones where they're like instantaneous, and then like they fall out. It's like almost something I do where it's like scrunching my nose, making a little noise, doing some kind of simple motion. And then there are the complex ones where I get like what we call a premonitory urge, which is like this kind of uncomfortable feeling or like a sense of dread. And then I get this, I'm compelled to do like an obsessive compulsion action, which for me then was like touching my mouth and saying piss, is essentially my brain is trying to self-regulate its neurotransmitters. And so one of the big things that we talk about in the Tourette's Association is this kind of exchanging the use of the word obscene words, talk about them more as taboo words, because it's the taboo in itself is what makes our brains do it. Because your brain doesn't think of taboo words as words. It thinks of them as concentrated balls of emotion. So if you've ever like kicked a piece of furniture and stubbed your toe, and then you swear at the furniture and you feel better afterwards, that's because the way your brain has processed that kind of scenario is that you have sworn and kind of released an emotion, which means that often it can be very kind of specific to the area or the time that you are. So, for example, like I get, gay. I get a lot of tics that are about bombs and drugs when I'm at the airport, when I'm in a place where it's taboo to talk about those things. But I don't have tics about those things in my normal day-to-day because it's not a taboo to talk about them. And so I've heard a little bit of discourse about people talking about how like, oh, but he only said those words when they were on stage. And it's like, yes, because it was only a taboo in his mind when they were on stage.
There have been people out there, like we had Jamie Foxx saying that was unacceptable and that John Davidson meant it. And you're saying, no, the words that we say, it's not some deep thought that we're having. It's just a taboo word.
It's almost the exact opposite. And so John probably has lots of concerns about being viewed as a racist, which then causes the huge taboo to use racist words.
This really interesting conversation. We're getting a lot of messages coming through. It's Hack. I'm Dave Marchese speaking with Connor Macy about Tourette's syndrome on the back of this controversy at the BAFTAs when a racial slur was shouted by someone with Tourette's syndrome. On the text line, someone says, I do think it is racist and I'd like to hear what people of colour have to think about this. Another person says it's a disability. They can't control it. Connor, I'm wondering, as someone who has Tourette's syndrome, does it make you anxious when you're out and about, like meeting new people, getting around in the world? How does it feel?
You don't know how difficult it is sometimes entering every conversation you have three steps behind. You know, when I walk into a coffee shop and I look at the barista and I go, woo, fuck you, touch my penis. You know, I'm instantly five steps behind. I'm instantly then having to apologize, explain what's going on. And I just find it so interesting that all the pressures and all the difficulties that John is now facing is almost perfectly mirrored in the book that the movie that he was there for is about.
What do you say to the people out there who are commenting that John Davidson should not have been in this space where there may have been an issue, where he may have caused offence, that maybe he should have removed himself? How would you respond to that?
I guess then you're asking us to remove ourselves from every space. At that point, I'm encountering people at the supermarket when I go. I'm encountering small children. I'm encountering people of different races. I'm encountering people who I could easily offend at any moment. Like, we shouldn't have to jump through a big rigmarole, constantly having to explain ourselves, constantly having to mute ourselves and like go out of our way to protect other people's sensibilities when it's not something that's within our control.
What is the best way for someone to respond? Is it ever okay to laugh if it's something really funny? Like, what is the best way to deal with something like this?
I think it's difficult. I think a lot of people are on the kind of spectrum where they either like people to interact with it or don't like people to interact with it. I'm on a personal level where I prefer if someone comments on it, makes a joke in return or something like that, because then it clears my mind of what they're thinking. If I say something homophobic to one of my gay friends, and that I might still be concerned, even though I know that they know it's a tick and I don't mean it, I might still be concerned about what they're thinking and how they're feeling, and that's going to make my Tourette's worse. And it's definitely fine to laugh at Tourette's. I think I like to make the distinction that it's okay to laugh at the Tourette, but not the person. I was once in a line for a banh mi. I'm waiting for this banh mi, and there's a lady in front of me. I tap her on the shoulder and I go, ooh, touch my dick, make me hungry. And horrific. But in the moment, I was like appalled. I'm apologizing so much. It's like, it's a dreadful moment. But in hindsight, it's really funny. And it's like a thing that me and my family joke around all the time now. And then one other thing, especially when it's strangers and things like that, and they're hearing you tick in public. Look once, that's fine. Look twice, that's okay. Look three times, you're staring at me. And I think that so much of like what we as people with Tourette's need is just that kind of public awareness, just to be seen as people out and about living our lives.
Connor Macey, disability advocate, thank you very much for joining us on Hack. Really appreciate your time.
No, thank you for having me.
And we've got a lot of messages coming through. Leo says, think first, then speak. Leo, I think missing the point of this disability and the discussion we're having. We've got others coming through. Someone says they edited out someone saying free Palestine in their speech, but not the racist slur, that person asks. Another person says everyone should consider how they would feel if their fears or anxieties were something they had to voice uncontrollably due to a disability. All right, we're going to move on.
Hack. It's a big, complex field, but one we think the economic opportunities for Australia are huge.
On Triple J.
And let's talk about trains. Fast trains. I can feel all the rail fans leaning in, turning up the radio right now, because today there was an announcement from the federal government, the Prime Minister, saying he wants to pour more money, it's a lot of money too, into a high-speed rail project in New South Wales from Newcastle to Sydney. It'd bring the total spend to nearly $660 million before a single section of track is laid. What do you think of this? Is high-speed rail a good idea? Is it something you would like to see in Australia? Would you use it? Or you reckon it's a waste of money? It's too focused on the East Coast, especially if you are in another part of the country. Message in 0439757555. Already hearing from you on the text line. Someone says Newcastle gets a train and Canberra got a tram. The money for that tram could have built a hospital that Canberra needs more. Another person saying, I'll take high-speed rail seriously when I see concrete pillars go up. Yeah, we do hear a lot about these big infrastructure projects, not only in Australia but around the world, that are talked about, especially around elections, then don't really materialise. It's definitely an interesting one, this one, and it's something Louise Mylan's been looking into.
It's a pretty cool experience. You get out the speedometer, you see it's going at 300 kilometres an hour, and it is as smooth as anything.
When 21-year-old Max Cowrie caught his first bullet train overseas, he was more pumped than your average commuter.
There's always something to be excited about as a train enthusiast.
I've heard this new term recently, gunzel. Are you familiar?
Yes, yes. I think it's got positive connotations of being a little bit of a train nerd.
Max is the train man. Literally, that was the name of the dedicated YouTube channel he ran as a teenager before studying urban planning. So Max's ears perked up when he heard this today.
The business case says from Newcastle to Sydney in an hour, from Gosford to Sydney in 30 minutes.
That's Transport Minister Catherine King announcing an extra $230 million for a high-speed rail project between Sydney and Newcastle.
140 kilometres of track, 320 kilometres per hour capable trains.
That's more than twice as quick as the average Aussie train right now.
This one was doing 200 kilometres an hour.
Now, I know what you're thinking. Haven't we heard this before? Well, yes. People have been talking about high-speed rail in Australia for a really, really long time.
Probably since the 80s, I think, was the first proposal of proper high-speed rail in Australia.
It's a long list of dead ends, too. High-speed rail developments have never really gotten off the ground here, thanks to massive distances and spread-out populations, making it hard for governments to justify big spends.
Critics have expressed doubt about the cost-effectiveness of the train.
The latest funding announcement, which at this point is just between places in New South Wales, brings the total government spend to nearly $660 million. And that's just to suss out exactly how the whole thing will work. But Catherine King reckons it'll be worth it.
What it does is generate over $250 billion of economic activity, 99,000 jobs, potentially 160,000 homes throughout that region as well.
The PM's backed her in.
It would be a game changer for economic growth and for productivity.
Matt Canavan from the Nationals wants more detail.
I want to know how much it will cost first.
John Hirsch is the president of the Rail Futures Institute, which advocates for cost-effective rail options in Australia. He reckons it's time we invested in this technology that's now widespread across Europe and Asia.
Until recently, the population probably hasn't been there. But when you think about the population, you've got to think not just what it is now, but what it's going to be in 10, 20, 50 years' time. You know, these high-speed lines have a life of 100 years.
Another argument against high-speed rail in Australia is that we just don't have a train culture, preferring cars or planes.
Probably the main issue as well with people seeing high-speed rail in Australia. Will it actually work? Will people use it?
But in Max's view, we only have to look overseas to see how rail can become a beloved part of daily life.
Especially the Shinkansen and the bullet trains in Japan. People think of high-speed rail, they probably think of Japan first. And that's just been set up over the past 60 years and into the culture of the Japanese people.
And when it comes to the high-speed haters, John Hirst reckons, build it and they'll come.
People will be clamouring for it to be extended and they'll love high-speed rail once it comes.
So if New South Wales gets this super-fast train, could we see a rail network like this around Australia, like to Canberra or Melbourne or even longer distances? Well, even Max knows that's a big ask.
The costs, I think, are just going to be too insurmountable for people to, I guess, justify.
But a train enthusiast can dream.
Well, pipe dream would be to connect every city, right? I mean, how cool would it be to go from Sydney to Perth on a train and it take 6, 8 hours, 9 hours? Like, that would be incredible.
Hack on Triple J.
Louise Mylan reporting there. We've got so many messages coming through right now. Someone says, yes, to high-speed train. It should have happened ages ago, and over the decades it should expand far beyond Sydney and Newcastle. This has the potential to help with the housing crisis, overcrowding in cities, airlines price gouging, and so much more. Another person says, I live in Newcastle and I don't want a fast train. What it'll mean is that Sydney-siders will move here, increasing property prices, squeezing people further in the rental market and leading to even more homelessness, that person says. Another person, high-speed expertise in this country would be great. Disrupt Melbourne and Sydney flights. I'm not sure if the numbers stack up for Newcastle, though. A lot of people bring up airlines and flights and what this could mean for the cost of travelling in other ways across this country. We've got someone on the line now. Amy's with us. Amy, you're not in Newcastle. Where are you?
No, I'm in Albury-Wodonga.
Okay,
so you're the border between Victoria and New South Wales.
And how do you feel about these potential plans for a high-speed rail link between Newcastle and Sydney?
I think the frustrating thing is that like Newcastle basically is part of Sydney anyway already. Like down here, the train to Melbourne is great. But if I want to go to Canberra, the train doesn't even go the whole way from Albury to Canberra. You have to catch a coach.
Yeah.
Like, how can you not go? Like, there's over 100,000 people in Albury-Wodonga. Why can't we just catch the train?
You're like, please, just fix our train system first. Why do you think, you know, some of these other projects aren't getting much attention, Amy?
Look, Albury-Wodonga always gets missed, being on the border. The New South Wales government goes, oh, Victoria will deal with it. Victorian government goes, oh, New South Wales will deal with it.
Yeah.
And we get missed out.
Well, look, you've got a by-election coming up soon, so maybe there'll be some extra announcements in the lead-up to that. I'm just laughing at all of the Novocastrians, the people from Newcastle who are cringing, thinking that they're a part of Sydney. They would be hating that. Amy, thank you so much for calling in and for having a chat with us about that. Let's get into this discussion a bit more now with Matt Burke, who is an adjunct professor at Griffith University and a sustainable transport expert. He knows a lot about this and he's been following these developments for a while. G'day, Matt. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem.
What do you reckon? I mean, we've been hearing about, you've been writing about high-speed rail in Australia for years. Do you think this is actually going to happen?
Yeah, I do. I think the section to Newcastle is pretty much locked in now as something that we're likely to fund. The next stage of planning is necessary to get that going. How fast or whether we get high-speed rail going along the entire East Coast from Melbourne right up to Brisbane, that's a much bigger question. But I think we're now preserving the corridors and we're building what would be the most expensive bit first.
So what kind of timeline would we be looking at? Like, when would you expect to see the first length of this high-speed rail opened?
Oh, it'll take a good decade from here before we're running trains up and down from Newcastle. I would expect by 2035 or so would be the earliest. But, you know, money can move things quicker, but there's an awful lot of geotechnical work, tunnelling work and other things that are needed for this. 10-year horizon looks minimum to me.
I was reading a piece that you wrote a few years ago, Matt, and, you know, weighing up whether we needed high-speed rail and the benefits, the cons as well associated with it. I guess Australia and the world has changed a bit in the few years since you wrote that piece. I'm wondering, do you think we need high-speed rail now in Australia?
I still think it would have some value. The cost is the problem. And the particular spatial geography of Australian cities being so far apart. There's only one high-speed train line in the world that's profitable. That's in Japan, and it's between Tokyo, Yokohama, which has more people than all of Australia, and Osaka, a city with just a couple of million people less than all of Australia. And, you know, it stops through little towns no one's heard of, like Nagoya with, you know, 7 or so million people, bigger than Sydney. So it's a very different landscape there. But, yeah, it's going to cost an awful lot of money. And then the question is, would we be better off doing something else with that in the sustainable transport sense, or is this our best bang for buck?
Yeah, because I imagine there would be people in other parts of Australia listening right now thinking, hold on, that is so much money to spend on a small part of the country and along the East Coast when they're Australia's a big country. There are huge sections that are really inaccessible to many people that we need better transport links.
And even within the cities, there's so, like, for one-tenth of the money of high-speed rail, we could totally build out the bicycle and active transport networks and have amazingly livable cities.
It was interesting hearing you say that there's only one high-speed rail system in the world that's profitable. I mean, people might have travelled on other systems, maybe in Europe, in Italy, in France, places like that. How do they get by? Is it through subsidies? How are they able to continue?
Yeah, they're very subsidised in Europe. The French and German systems are not so bad. The Spanish system is very heavily subsidised. Again, some very long distances between the cities. But what we're going to see with the Newcastle to Sydney version will have some of Australia's most subsidised transport commuters. It won't be tourists, it won't be day trippers, it will be regular travellers who are really getting a very high subsidy to do that trip. The system will make sense by about 2060, something like that. The system from Brisbane all the way down to Melbourne. And, you know, various studies have suggested the time frame for that might be 2080, it might be 2085, or it might be a bit earlier than that. I'm a bit more optimistic.
Very interesting. Think about when that could be. I imagine if I do see it, I'll be buying some kind of concession ticket to travel on the high-speed train.
It may not be in my lifetime. Yes, indeed.
It may not be. Matt Burke from Griffith University, really appreciate your time.
Thanks.
And I've got to say, I wasn't prepared for the response that we would receive from this, not just the Newcastle community, but a lot of Novocastrians hitting the text line right now. Someone says they've been saying they're planning on putting this train on for years. Every promise just feels more hollow than the last to me. Josh in Newcastle says, yes, high-speed train would be fantastic, so a day trip to Sydney does not take 7 hours out of you. Another person, Melbourne, still doesn't have rail to the airport, let alone high-speed rail. And someone else says, I lived in Japan 7 years. High-speed rail was awesome. Would massively reduce carbon emissions of short-haul flights. I do remember when I was working in Newcastle, someone saying that it was quicker to get from Sydney to Newcastle on the train in the 1940s than it is now. Don't know if that's true. Someone can fact check that. Maybe it should be me next time. That is all for Hack for now. Abby and Tyrone are going to be back with you with a first play from a Newcastle-based band, which makes sense. And I'll catch you tomorrow.